Okay. We are thrilled with the turnout that we have tonight. Welcome to Dallas Sponsor Forum. I'm Rob Olson. Welcome everyone. We've been on the second or fourth Tuesday of every month from September through May. We have any first-time visitors? We have a few first-time visitors. Raise your hand. Okay. Oh, yeah, Nick. Okay, great. How'd you hear about us? Through the First Unitarian Church, right? And your mom. Any other first-time visitors? Oh, yes. Yeah, what is your name, young lady?
Barbara.
Happy to hear about us. You're it. Okay, very good. Welcome. Glad
but
you're
he
here.
But didn't tell me early enough to eat.
Oh, he didn't tell you early enough to eat. Well, you need to get here early next time. Okay, great. So, once again, if you haven't paid, then our treasurer's right back over there with a red tie. You can do so now or immediately after the lecture. It costs us $5 and $2 if you're a student. Also, I want to remind everyone to pay your bill. Sometimes every once in a while someone might forget. Have your attention, please. Thank you. So make sure that you, the $5 admission does not include the meal from this restaurant. So anyway, make sure that you pay your bill and your generously tip your waitstaff. We appreciate it. We have a website that has all this. It's www.philosophersforum.org. You can also sign up to get meeting notices through Meetup, and that's a great way to, as far as a reminder. Our speaker will be talking for about 45 minutes, and we'll open it up to questions. And then I want to ask you to make sure you turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate at this time. We appreciate that. Also, I passed up to most of you a talk that's coming up. Integral philosopher Steve McIntosh will be speaking on the presence of the infinite. That's Sunday, November 1st at 7 p.m. at SMU's Perkins School of Theology. So we have some more of these. So if you want to get a copy of this, I'll have this after the meeting as well. We are really very fortunate to have Dr. Lynn Galbraith with us tonight. He has quite an impressive resume. He was born in Chicago. I won't go through every single thing.
I want to hear it.
Judy wants to hear it all.
What?
He grew up in the United States. He spent a fair number of years in Japan. Is that right, Wynn? He attended 19 schools before he went to college at MIT. And you couldn't have gotten a better school than MIT? That's the best one you get into. He started out in physics, switched to philosophy in physics, graduated with a BS in philosophy and physics. That's quite a combination. That's a very interesting combination. He subsequently acquired his master's in theology from Western Seminary in Holland, Michigan. He was a minister, so no customs tonight. He was a minister in Second Reformed Church in Tarrytown, New York. Then went to Pittsburgh to study in a new joint program at the University of Pittsburgh. And he acquired one doctorate in three disciplines, so it's sort of an interdisciplinary degree, right, Wynn?
Yeah.
Philosophy, history and philosophy of science, and theology. So we have a highly educated man with us tonight. And then he taught at the regional campus of the University of Pittsburgh in philosophy and religious studies. Then he felt like he was uneducated. So he decided to go back to school, and he got a master's degree in information science, and then became a computer scientist with EIA. I could go on and on and on, but I won't. I just want to... Dr. Galbraith will be speaking this evening on noumena, phenomena, intuition, and epistemology. And now please give us a warm welcome to Dr. Glenn Galbraith.
Thank you. Are we on?
No.
Okay. I'm going to probably go pretty fast with some of this because I have more material than I can cover, so.
Let's start with the definition of phenomenon, noumena, and then
after a couple of slides, I'll give you my conclusions up at the front, so you know where I'm going. This stick-figure man, we'll call him George, I created with a big head so I could stick phenomena in there. The phenomena are his impressions of what's out there.
Outside his head. What's outside his head, this stuff over here, is noumena.
Noumena is a term invented by Immanuel Kant, and I like it, so I'm going to use it even before Kant.
Now, of course, the big question is whether the phenomena are just representations of the noumena. Are they accurate? Is it real? And, of course, I biased this a bit because you can see my phenomenal house over here is not quite the same as the noumenal house. The noumenal house has a chimney, the phenomenal house doesn't. So it's, you know, sort of like it, but... And over here, the phenomenal triangle, down-pointing triangle, doesn't actually exist over here.
But you can see it nonetheless.
I put this in just to give you an idea of the struggle that the mind has to try to make sense, to intuitively grasp something that is noumenal nonsense. Although some people insist that, hey, if you gave me three pieces of wood, I could make that.
That magazine did.
Here's another instance of the difference in the phenomenon and the noumena. Even though I tell you that square A is exactly the same shade as square B, most of you are going to tell me, no, they're not. That's not how I see it. I'll come back to this slide at a later time. Okay, here's my conclusions. We do not know the noumena. The mind creates images of the noumena, which we'll call phenomena. And we tend to think that we experience the noumena by way of the phenomena. These images are consistent with and limited by the structures, functions, and capabilities of the mind. I call the conceptual aspects of the phenomena, by which we try to understand the phenomena, intuitions. I'm aware that I'm using the word intuition differently than others have. Some use it this way, most don't. But all right, that's how I want to use it. These intuitions are built by the mental capacities that we have, and those mental capacities have evolved. They're simplifications of noumenal realities twice removed. Because you start with the noumena, then we have the phenomena in the mind, and then we have, between the phenomena and the rest of our mind, these intuitive concepts that we use to interpret the phenomena. So it's not just blah, an experience. It's blah, interpreted. And there's a certain inner subjectivity of these intuitions because they're pretty obvious fallout from the mental capacities. And those of us who are discussing them are all from the same species, so we all have the same ideas. And I call those ideas naive realism. Okay, and it's not really adequate. And I'm not saying it's not adequate for survival. It is highly adequate for survival. It's not adequate in the quest for truth or proper representation, something of that sort. In fact, these naive realism ideas. Things are as they appear to be, as I intuitively conceive them to be. This is highly misleading.
We're constantly finding flaws in it, or else we don't find the flaws in it. We use it to try to deceive somebody else, like advertising, or politicians, or entertainers, etc.
Professors?
Yeah, sometimes professors.
Finishing the conclusions, absolute proof about the noumena doesn't exist. Proof is contingent on some fundamental assumptions. And those fundamental assumptions can't be proved because they're fundamental. If we try to prove them, then we would prove them on the basis of other fundamental assumptions. And if we replace some of those assumptions with other assumptions, then what we thought was obviously true, now we think is probably false, or at best is an approximation. What we actually do is to choose a paradigm. You must have put quotes on that, choose.
we may create that paradigm, or we may just adopt or adapt somebody else's paradigm. And the choice, however, is sometimes unconscious, sometimes coerced, but nonetheless, we're responsible for it. It's our choice. And then we build a network of concepts relating to that paradigm by which we try to understand what we are experiencing. Evidence to the contrary to any given piece of that paradigm can be integrated into that that network of ideas. For example, if I think that all A's are B's, and I come across an A that is obviously not a B, I can continue to say that all A's are B's except that case. That's the case, the exception that proves the rule, all A's are B, or something like that. I can rationalize it. I can come to the conclusions that I still have it right, basically. I'm going to deal with four episodes in the history of thought. Early Buddhism, 2,500 years ago, and I know Kant's Copernican Revolution, published with a critique of pure reason in 1781. Einstein's theory of relativity, special case, a little bit of the general, as of 1905, and cognitive science current, which is difficult to deal with. Let's see if I can get on with that. These are examples of what I think to be good epistemology. I'm not saying they're correct. I disagree with something about every one of these. Okay, but they're good examples, and I think they're pinnacles, mountaintops of human effort to understand reality. So my argument is not that I can prove something from these. I mean, I can't prove that I can't prove things. what I can do is to argue, you know, these are good examples, go thou and do likewise. And I have to make a disclaimer. I'm not trying to argue that views are expressed. I'm not even arguing that my interpretation of these noumenal entities is the correct interpretation, because all I have is the phenomenal. So I can't say it's for sure that's right. I can only say that this is the interpretation I have. And these are, in turn, interpretations of something else. My primary interest is in epistemology. So we'll start with Buddha.
Yes.
Over 2,500 years ago in India, there were numerous schools of thought about what was real or important. In particular, I want to zero in on about three of these. The Carvakas, a form of Hinduism, were empiricists. Okay, perception is the only source of knowledge, the only true source of knowledge. They're materialists, and they're monists. There's only one kind of stuff, matter. And all this stuff about moksha, afterlife, reincarnation, samsara, kara, religious rites, religious texts, that's all superstitious nonsense. Should be tossed. Okay? And then ethically, they recommend hedonism. Alright? That's the stance. It was a popular stance in Buddhist time. There are other schools that were pretty much the same. One called the Ajivikas. That way. Same one.
Those are my boys.
Yeah, well, it's still a popular stance. Then there are the dualists, the Jains. The Jains is one of the oldest religions in the world. It's impressive. We can only trace it historically back to around 600-700 BC, but the Vidyamara statues date back to like 2900 BC, so it's really old. They are dualists. There's souls and matter, two types of stuff, okay? And unfortunately, souls are tainted by sticky matter that sticks to them. And that sticky matter, that karma matter, obscures the truth, makes it difficult for people to see what's really so. However, by ascetic practices, you can scrape off some of that sticky stuff, and then you get closer to realizing the truth. That's the Jains, okay? So they're recommending asceticism. And then there are the Orthodox Hindus. And rather than talk about it here, I'll go to the next slide. I'm interested in the epistemology of the more advanced versions of that, such as Vedanta, okay? The idea here, we see a batch of noumenal entities there, and we see a batch of phenomenal entities inside George's head. This stuff outside, the Advaita Hindus would say, is actually only an illusion. It's really all an expression of Brahman, the god Brahman. But there is another god who's actually also part of Brahman, whose name is Maya. I think we probably get the word magic from there. Maya does this peculiar little dance and deceives us into thinking that there are real things out here. Okay? So in any case, we have these perceptions of what we think is real out here because of Maya dancing. Maya is a demon, a devil, okay? You see him again with Descartes, who has to argue, you know, if there is a devil trying to deceive me, nonetheless, I know I must exist because who's he trying to deceive? Okay, so inside the mind, there are the phenomena, which are created by the Atman. But this is Atman, A-T-M-A-N, meaning the self or the soul of the individual. Okay? Individual self. But behind these individual selves, one for each of us, there is the one true God, Atman, with a capital A. The real self, okay, in whose mind we all exist. So I've tried to indicate in a rather fuzzy way the unknown extent of Atman's mind. And the other piece is that Atman and Brahman are the same. So if you look into yourself hard enough, you might well see the unity of the object and the subject. You can overcome the subject-object dichotomy by meditating. Now, Buddha said, this stuff about Brahman and Atman, that's just ideas in the head. Okay? It's not real. It's superstitious thought. But that distinction between the noumena and the phenomena, that's real. He didn't use the word noumena. Okay? But this distinction is real. It's important. Buddha is best seen as a doctor. He said, one thing only have I taught, dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. And if you're going to say that's two things, you're just being picky. All conditioned existence is dukkha. You could read that as all life is dukkha. Everything that we experience is dukkha. Well, what is dukkha is a Sanskrit term that has a lot of different translations. It could be pain. It could be suffering, it could be anxiety, or frustration, illness, or dis-ease in the sense of I'm not at ease, I'm frustrated by something, or you know, things aren't just right. It could be just a hollow feeling that it's all pointless and we know what's happening, what's worth anything. Ignorance and craving lead to dukkha, and we'll go into some more about how this works in a minute. We can cause dukkha to cease, at least largely, by using the path to the cessation of dukkha, which is the Eightfold Path. If you'll notice that most of this stuff is purely mental, and the rest of it is action based on mental grasp. So it's largely mental. And for this reason, a lot of people have said that Buddha should be understood as a psychologist. But actually, Buddha's interests are somewhat broader. He does have a metaphysics and an epistemology. In his ethics, he took the middle way between hedonism and asceticism. Remember, hedonism is Descartes, asceticism is James. So the two prominent schools of philosophy at his time, he stands in the middle. At least, well, not only ethically, but also metaphysically and epistemologically. Also, everything is in process. I got to tell this little story. I had this professor of Eastern philosophy, and I asked him to explain Buddhist ontology or metaphysics. And he said, you know Whitehead? And I said, you mean Alfred North Whitehead? He said, yeah. Buddhism is the same thing. And that was kind of sad for me because I didn't really understand Whitehead. And I'm thinking, you know, like, shucks. Now he thinks I know Whitehead and Buddhism. So anyway, I went too far. Let's go back. Everything is in process. Things are not essences. He's speaking against the concept of a static existence, a static nature to things. Everything is built out of rapidly changing confluence of elements from the five skandhas. Skanda means heap or pile. Now we got these five different sources of stuff. And, you know, some of them come together, and that's an entity, okay? Either noumenal or phenomenal. And it's in process, because one of these is going to take off, and another one join, and then another one takes off, and another one join, and then two more join, and three more take off. And, you know, it's constantly changing. And he says, you are not the person you were 10 years ago. You've changed. And not only that, you're not the person you were 10 minutes ago. Okay, there's a constant change going on. So it's an incorrect idea to say that there is a soul or a self, because it doesn't exist as an essence. It exists only as a process. If you look at what's going on in your mind, you have processes going on in your mind. Your mind itself can be seen as a process or a set of processes. And that's what he's pointing to. It doesn't exist as a static entity. It doesn't have a specific essence. He stressed the impermanence of everything and thus the non-existence of the soul or self. Now, most of us could understand easily the non-existence of the soul, because that's something that's supposed to, you know, maintain its existence through long periods of time, forever maybe. Okay? But the self, what about the self? Can you really say the self doesn't exist? Well, Buddha doesn't really say the self doesn't exist. What he says is the self is a process. And as a process, you can speak of it, okay? You should encourage yourself. You should do this, you know, the individuals should take care of themselves, etc. But don't think that that's a static essence. It's not. It's a process. We tend to make nouns of these transitory compilation of events from this context. That's something that humans do, okay? They tend to concretize things. They think of them as nouns, as static existing essences. And this is misleading. It leads to misplaced desires and thus to dukkha. If you quest after fame, fortune, power, wealth, beauty, whatever it is, one or two things will happen. Either you get it, and then it dissolves in front of you, and you're frustrated and unhappy, or you don't get it, and then you're frustrated and unhappy. Okay? So the cure to this is not to get locked into the idea of craving after it, desiring it, because you recognize that it doesn't last. It's just a process. And that's true of space and time. They are codependent. They're, you know, impacted by everything. Everything infects everything else, and space and time are not independent, objective existences. They don't exist independent with everything else. Refusing to be misled may allow us to break the chain and lead to the cessation of dukkha. Now we get to the heart of his epistemology. There is the idea that Buddha spoke about of two levels of truth, conventional and alternate. We could say phenomenal and noumenal. The noumenal level, he didn't, but that's basically what he's talking about, the real, the absolute, the one, versus the phenomenal, the relative, the manifold. Now, that idea was also present among the Hindus. But Buddha takes a slightly different tack toward it. He points out that it's all really empty. Nagarjuna points out that these are empty as well, and gives a lot more detail, which we could go into, but I won't. The point is not to take either of them too seriously. It's a middle path that he's seeking. So let me tell you a little story about the concept of self. Buddha was approached at one point by a would-be disciple who sat down in the proper position of respect and said to the Buddha, "Is it the case that the self exists?" And Buddha just looked at him. Quiet. And then the fellow said, well, is it the case that the self does not exist? And Buddha just looked at it. And so finally he got up, frustrated, and left. And one of Buddha's disciples came over and said, why did you do that? And Buddha said, well, if I said the self exists, he would have thought that I was siding with the eternals, the Jains, okay? Having an eternal soul. If I said that the self does not exist, he would have thought that I was siding with the Carvacas, the nihilists, the ones that blow everything away. And he doesn't want to take either, because both of those are built on conceptions that he doesn't like. I won't go into that second illustration yet. This is a chunk of quoted material taken directly from, letter for letter, from a Wikipedia article on non-duality. It's dealing with epistemology, non-dual epistemology. Advaita is a non-essentialist epistemological approach. You know, the thing is, it's probably written by a Buddhist. And I hate to disagree with it. So I only question a little bit of it. It questions what we can know about reality. It states that there is no absolute transcendent reality. That's the part I have a problem with. I'm not quite sure what he means by absolute transcendent reality. I mean, if he means the one or the Brahman, that's right. But I know of instances where Buddha refused to negate that. So I have a problem with that. It also denies the existence of inherently existing things or essences. Nothing has an inherent essence. According to this definition, non-duality refers to the non-duality between the absolute and the relative. Those are the two levels of truth. Okay? It's the recognition that ultimately everything is devoid of an everlasting and independent essence, and that this emptiness does not constitute an absolute reality in itself. Bounce down to the last point. It's exemplified in Majjhimagga Buddhism and its insight into the emptiness or non-existence, of inherently existing things. Now, how can you say that existing things don't exist? Well, yeah, what he's saying is processes don't have an essence. Okay? And the emptiness of emptiness. The whole concept of emptiness is empty. Okay? Emptiness does not in itself constitute an absolute reality. So that second, or the ultimate level of truth, that's 52. Don't get hooked on it. It's the middle way between eternalism, okay, that's the Jains, and annihilation, that's the Carvaka. Okay, so Advaita, or this concept of truth, says the noumenal things out here, we don't know anything about. Even to say they don't exist would make a knowledge claim about them. So let's not do that. This stuff in here is misperceived because we tend to think of it as an essence in noun form, static existences, and that's incorrect. This is probably an apocryphal quote. I got it from verybestquotes.com. But it does have the advantage of giving a flavor for Buddha's view of the phenomenon. You know, we are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. So, we do not know the noumena. The mind creates images of the noumena. These intuitions are built by mental capacities. He didn't know anything about evolution, so I put that in brackets. This naive realism is inadequate. It leads to dukkha. Absolute proof about the noumena doesn't exist. What we actually do is to choose a paradigm. If we choose the wrong one, we end up in dukkha. Let's talk about Kant. Kant was trying to say the concept of knowledge, to say that maybe we do know something. His systematic philosophy can be seen as a synthesis, or alternatively as a tombstone, for the two major traditions of his time, which are rationalism and empiricism. Rationalism, as exemplified by Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz, Malebranche, Wolff, Baumgarten, These all took the view that reason is the key that can allow us to find truth. The empiricists, on the other hand, are people like Locke, Berkeley, Hume, lived in England, almost all of them. And they said that the key to knowledge is our experience, our sensations. Both of these traditions are troubled by skeptics. Neither could give a good idea why one should believe them. Rationalism seemed unguided and prone to imaginative constructions, like idealism and solipsism, and also Leibniz's monads. I mean, really, I am a monad. I have no conception of what's outside my own head. Okay, none. I'm a windowless monad. However, everything that I see is exactly what's happening out there because of a pre-established harmony created by God.
The super monad.
Yeah.
That's God.
Okay. But, you know, this is a bit much. If you believe that, I have a bridge to sell you. Empiricism could not give a reason to believe it or to think that there's any connection between the internal sense data that I have and the external realities. So we don't have confidence in matter, substance, causation, and whatnot. We can never even, by empiricism, know universals. I mean, you can't know that all A are B unless you've seen all A. And nobody has seen all the examples of something. You can come up with statements like all swans are white, but you don't know. There might in Australia be a black swan. let me move on. Kant's Copernican revolution of the mind is his proposal to change a basic fundamental assumption going on here. Instead of thinking that we want the noumena to correspond to the phenomena, or the phenomena correspond to the noumena, he says, let's give up on that hypothesis and suggest that the phenomena correspond to the way the mind works. Okay, if we can do that, if we can show that there are certain ways in which every experience that a human can have would correspond to or would conform to certain rules and regulations, then we could build a science on that. Okay, so that's what he's going to do. Unfortunately, that's a very difficult thing to do. In the Critique of Pure Reason, in his preface, he raises three questions. How is mathematical knowledge possible? How is scientific knowledge possible? And is metaphysical knowledge possible? You notice the change in form. That's because he's going to say no on the last one. It's not possible. It is not possible to know the noumenal things. Concepts like God, soul, everlasting life, heaven, hell, demons, devils, this is stuff that we cannot know. That doesn't mean that it might not be worth believing in some of this. Okay? He said that at one point to somebody that he had to destroy knowledge in order to make room for faith. Okay, that got him some points with the believers. So, how then do we answer these first two questions? Well, he said, what we need to do is to take that those two distinctions, which everybody up until now has assumed are the same distinction. So here's, you know, two possibilities, but actually they're four, because they're not the same distinction. So let's go over these distinctions. They deal with the truth or false claim of propositions or statements. So the distinction between analytic and synthetic is analytic propositions are such that the predicate is contained in the subject. For example, all bachelors are unmarried. Unmarried is part of the definition of bachelor. You don't have to do a survey of bachelors to find out if all bachelors are unmarried. Because if somebody who claimed to be a bachelor was married, he wasn't properly claiming to be a bachelor. So these, we know analytically. And anything else is synthetic. I mean, if the content of the predicate is not contained over here, as for example, that swan is white, then we actually are synthesizing something. We're saying something about the subject by adding the predicate. So those statements
Incidentally, that is an example of a posteriori. A priori means
prior to experience.
A posteriori means
post experience, after experience. And the question is, how do you confirm this proposition? Do you use experience or not?
Well, Hume had said that all of these propositions that you might find in the book are either relations of ideas up here, or they're matters of fact down here.
Anything else, burn the book.
And Leibniz had said everything, all these propositions can be divided into two groups, truths of reason and contingent truths. So they assume that, you know, analytic a priori is one possibility, synthetic a posteriori is the other. Now, actually, Kant says there aren't anything here because the definition are contradictory. Predicate contained in the subject, he puts it in the analytic, but if that's the case, then you don't need to confirm it by experience. So this is empty, or at least useless. This over here, however, is a new idea. It's synthetic, and yet we know it before we experience anything. For example, every event is caused. Now don't confuse this with every effect is caused. Every effect is caused is analytic, because the effect is defined in terms of cause. But event is not defined in terms of cause. So when you say every event is caused, that's synthetic. Okay? And that is something you bring to the experiences that you have. Another one that you bring to the experience is that all objects are locatable in space. All experiences are locatable in time. Okay? So, so all I want to point to here is that time and space are forms of the mind. We don't get them, time and space, from experience. We impose them on experience. Okay? And that's why all of our experiences will have those forms of time and space. Going a little further, he finds that there are 12 pure categories of reason. just take a look at some of these here. Causality dependence is one. Cause and effect. That's something that is true of all our experiences. Not because things are really caused, but because in our minds we perceive them that way. Substance and accident, or matter and property. Okay, it's not that everything really is that way, but we perceive it that way. We structure it that way in our experiences. And so he finds several more. What happens if you attempt to apply the concepts which are appropriate inside the head to things outside the head? For example, let's ask the question, does the cosmos have a beginning in time? Well, if the cosmos has a beginning in time, or does not have a beginning in time, start with that one. Cosmos does not have a beginning in time. Then the current time is the end of an infinite sequence. But infinite sequences don't have ends. Therefore, that must be wrong. On the other hand, if the universe had a beginning in space and time, then we can ask, well, what was going on before that? And if the answer is nothing, because otherwise that would be the cosmos, well then, you know, was there something there, or was there something going on? No. Well then, how did it ever get started? That can't be. So we can throw out all of the ideas, okay? And the problem is just that we have taken concepts which apply to the phenomena and attempted to apply them to the noumena. Let's take another example. The self, we can understand the concept at least of the self as phenomena and the concept of the self as noumena. Is the self determined? Is it caused in all its detail? Well, over here it is, okay? That's the way we have to think about it. But if we think that that's true over here, then what is the point of ethics? You know, what's the point of exhortation, reward, punishment? What's the point of having a legal system? What's the point of social structures? It's all unnecessary. Much to do about nothing. So we have to think that what is out here is not caused. What's in here is. Oops. So, we don't know the noumenal. Mind creates images. These intuitions are built by mental capacities. Again, doesn't know anything about evolution. This naive realism is inadequate. Absolute truth about the noumenal doesn't exist. And what we actually do is to choose a paradigm, you know, like the self is determined, the self is not determined. And we build a network of concepts, of legal structures, whatever. Let's talk about Einstein. Special theory of relativity comes out of an apparent contradiction between the principle of relativity and
electromagnetic phenomena.
Principle of relativity, there are several ways of stating this. I'm going to limit myself at this point to the special theory of relativity. Says that in the case of inertial systems, I'll give you a diagram in a second. So that means no rotation or acceleration. The same laws of physics should apply. So if conservation of momentum and energy apply in one system, then in any other system moving in any other way, inertial frame reference, should also have the same form to its statements. Which means, among other things, we should be able to add and subtract velocities, which we've been doing for hundreds of years. Okay? However, the effort to measure the speed of light indicated that the speed of light seemed to be the same no matter what the relative motion of the observer or the source was. Which is a problem because, you know, if I'm moving along, let me go to the next one here. If I'm on the blue coordinate system, so you're on the black one, the x, y, z, and I'm x, y, z, t, and I'm x, y, z, x prime, y prime, z prime, and t prime, okay? And you shine a light, and I'm moving along next to it. It should seem to me that it's not moving at full speed of light. It should be c minus v. And if I'm going the other way, it should be c plus v. Okay? But it isn't. So it was suggested, okay, it's spelled by Nino Lorentz, came up with Lorentz transforms, which is if I have a point somewhere out here, which is visible to both of us, and we try to describe how to describe that location from your coordinate system to mine, or from mine to yours, we use these transforms. Okay, so the x and y, since I'm moving along the y and z, will be the same. But the x, my x, depends on your time. My distance depends on your time. And my time depends on your distance. And vice versa. So it seems that we can take time and space and trade them off. Okay? Which is rather unusual. Hermann Minkowski in 1907 wrote this. The views of space and time which I wish to lay before you have sprung from the soil of experimental physics. And therein lies their strength. They are radical. It's not just a little adjustment, because we're changing the whole concept of time and space. Henceforth, space by itself and time by itself are doomed to fade away into mere shadows, and only a kind of union of the two will preserve an independent reality. It's written over 100 years ago, and yet 99.999% of the human race still thinks the same way about space and time. Why is that? I'm going to suggest it's because we are hardwired to think of space in three dimensions moving back and forth in any of these dimensions. And we are hardwired to think of time as one dimension only, and we are moving in only one direction and at a constant speed through time. and it's not so. A couple of useful quotes here. The first one is from Einstein's introduction to Max Jamer's concepts of space, in which he says, the practicing scientists will be grateful to the historian if the latter can convincingly correct such views of purely intuitive origin. You know, he also elsewhere speaks of these intuitions as primitive intuitions, which need to be replaced, i.e. space and time.
The second quote from Synge, an Irish mathematician, writing in 1956, or publishing in 1956, a book on relativity and special theory, summarizes what Einstein is saying. I like this quote because I couldn't find a similar quote from Einstein himself in less than 50 pages. So he summarizes it neatly. To understand a subject, one must tear it apart and reconstruct it in a form intellectually satisfying to oneself. Now, when you have the phenomena, you don't necessarily understand the phenomena. You just have an experience, okay, which might mean nothing at all. Okay? But you also have these intuitive concepts between the experience and the rest of your mind, which allows you to understand the relationship of these phenomenal experiences among themselves and to you or to others. It gives you the possibility of making some sort of prediction about what will happen next or where it came from, that sort of thing. But in order to really understand, you need to tear these things apart and replace them with something better. This is what Newton did, for example, when he replaced concepts of physics in his day with the concepts that we now call vectors. Vector velocity, vector acceleration, vector force, F equals ma, etc. It's a vector equation from which we can deduce equations of motion, etc. Well, hey, this is a big improvement over what had gone before. But it leads us into these contradictions that Einstein is pointing to. So in order to improve on that, we have to tear those apart and replace them with better concepts, which are what you get from Einstein's special theory of relativity. And that doesn't yet include gravitation and a few other phenomena, so we need to tear those apart and replace them with the general theory. And that isn't really satisfactory, so we need to go on to a unified field theory, which he never finished. And when you do this, in view of the differences in individual minds, it's likely to be different from the original form. It's likely to be different from somebody else does, too. And this new synthesis is, of course, not an individual effort, but for it, one must, in the end, take individual responsibility. You choose it. It's yours. Okay. This is not just a minor correction at high speeds or for heavy bodies. Simultaneity and now, Einstein says, are not objective concepts. There is no such thing as now. Neither is space and time objective concepts. They're not. And if I have my impression of space and time, I can do the measurements and so forth of space and time, and they're right. And somebody else can do the measurements of space and time in their system, and they're right, and they disagree. Mass and energy are the same. What appears to be matter is only a density in the fields of force. Particles and mechanics are inept concepts, he says. We should do away with them, replace them with fields and partial differential equations. Time on the mountaintop passes at a different rate than in the valley. That's from the general theory. The universe is not Euclidean. It's Riemannian. Okay? Or, you know, possibly it could be Lobachevskian, but it's really Riemannian. It's not Euclidean. We think it is. Straight lines, planes, they do not mean anything from now on. There is no objective significance to a straight line. It depends on the curvature of space. Stephen Hawking and Green point out that Einstein proclaimed, that's really too strong a term, although they say that, but I'd say, you know, may have implied that all objects in the universe are always traveling through space-time at a fixed speed, that of light. We're going through four dimensions, okay? If, relative to an observer, I am not moving in space, then I am going through time at the speed of light. If I am moving a little bit, relative to that observer, then my passage through time is reduced. Okay? And if I am moving relative to that observer at the speed of light, then that observer is going to insist that I'm not experiencing time at all. I don't have any motion through time. I, on the other hand, will say, of course I have the same motion through time as I've always had. And both are right. Space and time can and do expand and stretch, compress, twist, even get ripped and annihilated.
I can annihilate nothing.
Well, that's a bad conception of space. There are no forces acting at a distance.
We typically say, F equals G times M1, M2 over R squared.
No. It's not a force acting at a distance. Gravity is identical to acceleration, and it doesn't depend solely on mass and distance. Rotating bodies drag space and time into a spiral configuration. Space and time are actually created by these fields of force. They don't exist without them. We cannot apply the concept of the struggle that we have with our concepts. We cannot really apply the concept before to the Big Bang. But we want to anyway. Okay, because that's the way our minds are built.
I'm going to skip through a lot of these. The question of truth of the quotations from Einstein. The question of truth of the individual geometrical propositions is thus reduced to one of the truth of the axis. Now, it's long been known that the last question is, in itself, entirely without meaning. As far as propositions of mathematics refer to reality, they're not certain. As far as they're certain, they don't refer to reality. Go to the bottom one. The belief in an external world independent of the perceiving subject is the basis of all natural science. Since, however, sense perception only gives information of this external world indirectly, i.e., as a phenomenon, we can only grasp the latter, that is, the noumena, by speculative means. It follows from this that our notions of physical reality can never be final. We must always be ready to change these notions. That is to say, the axiomatic basis of physics.
Elsewhere he says, there is no final physics.
So, we don't know the noumena.
We only have the phenomena, which is an indirect representation of the noumena. And the intuitions that we have, actually, he uses the word evolved in terms of these intuitions. He says, our intuitions about physics evolve. He doesn't say that the capacities of the mind evolve. Okay.
This naive realism is inadequate. We don't really understand things that way. Absolute proof about the noumena doesn't exist. There's no final physics.
We choose a paradigm. It's our responsibility to choose it. Then we build a network
of thoughts. Cognitive science. The last episode. How does cognition work and what causes these intuitions that we have? All of these guys are still alive, and they represent numerous different fields. Chomsky is a linguist, Fodor is a philosopher, she's a psychologist, he's an anthropologist, he's a psychologist,
and we'll throw in a couple more too.
I'm going to speed up a little bit. In 1983, Fodor published The Modularity of the Mind, in which he summarized the state of psychology at his time and pointed out that we could better understand it in terms of a group of modules. I'll give you a diagram in a minute. In 1992, that's just 9 years later, Cosmides and Tooby and others came up with the concept of massive modularity, which is a little bit different, but related. It builds on what Fodor said. So here, according to Fodor, the characteristic of modules of the mind, they're domain-specific. And he's talking about input models. Central processing unit, as he calls it, is not modular. It's a Turing machine. It can handle all kinds of input and create all kinds of output. Okay. But the input modules are domain-specific. That is, they recognize inputs of a certain type only, such as visual stimuli, auditory stimuli, pain, temperature, something like that. And they operate in an automatic fashion. Once they get a stimulus, boom, they give an output very fast, 1/10 of a second or less. The output is shallow in the sense that it's not fully interpreted. It leaves a little room for the central processing unit to continue. What you're looking at here is the same thing that Kahneman talks about in terms of thinking fast and thinking slow. Okay? So basically, all of psychology has changed in cognizance of this. And it's associated with fixed neural architecture. In other words, there are certain specific neurons that are involved in each of these modules. And if they are damaged, you will get a characteristic breakdown pattern. I won't go into examples of that, but I could, I suppose. Something's wrong here. Okay. Here's... Oh, I know what I did. I put those in. Here's the same diagram as before, except that I added a color strip, which is a constant color strip between A and B. The idea is so you can see that A is actually the same color as B. Of course, most of you will say it's not really constant color. It shades. But if you hold your hands in such a way that you block out most of the video, you'll be able to see that it is pretty much the same. But you have this input module that insists on saying, nah, they're different. And it's encapsulated. There is no interference from the central processing unit to tell you that that's wrong. It really should be different. And if that one didn't interest you, this is the Euler-Lyer illusion. Most people say that this lower red line is shorter than the upper red line. They're not. It's the same length. Now, here's this diagram on the modularity of the mind. Here's the central processing unit, which, according to Fulrod, does not have any modules in it. I've shown it as having some modules just to represent what the massive modularity hypothesis did. But we have, you know, a retina and then two or three modules that interpret the retina and give that information to the central processing. We have the cochlea and a few mental modules that interpret what that hears, and then the other senses, etc. Central processing has access to memory, which these don't. And then on the output side, there are more modules. So, sample list of current set of modules for cognitive science. Kinship index. In fact, most of Genesis is this, kinship index. I see somebody, how are they related to me? And that impacts what I'm looking to do for them. Mate selection, cheater detection, hyperactive agency detection, which is why people believe in God. Okay, more on that in a minute. Theory of mind, intuitive physics. The theory of mind is what makes us think that everybody else we see has a mind and is capable of thinking about things and reacting to it. Intuitive physics or naive physics, naive biology, naive sociology, etc. And then over here, spatial perception. I want to zero in on that one. Special interest. It's good illustration. In the annual review of neuroscience for 2008, Moser and Kropf came up with a multi-page article. And here I think it's from the first paragraph and here from the last. I like these quotes. In agreement with the general ideas of Kahn, which is why I like this. Place cells and grid cells on hippocampal and entorhinal cortices may determine how we perceive and remember our position in the environment, as well as the events we experience in that environment. Spatial navigation, at the end, he says, may become one of the first non-sensory cognitive functions to be understood in reasonable mechanistic detail. Now, what we're doing here is we're trying to analyze what's known as, path integration. And what is that? Here's a map on the wall in front of you. And here's a point on this map, which happens to be the nest of the Montebello ant. Thousands of them, okay? A scout ant comes out of that, moves around like this. Takes hours, traveling around. And then over here, it finds what it's looking for. Termites. Back to the camp. Thousands of ants pour out to eat the termites. Okay, how does it do that? Well, it doesn't have a computer with it, to do a path integral across its path with its velocity and orientations, etc. How does it function? Well, it functions by virtue of a module called place cells, a module called grid cells, and so forth. Okay, and here's some diagrams relating to these grid place and boundary cells. I'll just talk about the first four here. These first three are all relating to grid cells. What you're looking at here is the bottom of a box about so by so, okay, with a rat in it. And the rat has a needle attached to a specific cell in the entorhinal cortex. Okay? It happens to be what we now call grid cells. And the black line is a track of the path of that rat. The red dots are cases where that particular cell fired off an electrical signal. Okay? What you get over here is supposed to be the same data. I think there's a little bit more that should be over here, but you know, it get too cluttered. The same cell, all one cell, okay, that is correlating with itself the activity of that cell. How often does it fire when it's in a given place? For example, right here, where it's dark blue, that means it never fires, or it fires up to 20% of the time. That's dark blue. Dark red means it fires 80 to 100% of the time. Okay? And if you do this autocorrelation, you see that, hey, you get a pattern here. And the pattern is a series of dots with each dot surrounded by six dots that are equidistant from it. Okay? And that's what you're seeing here, too, a grid. Each dot is surrounded by six dots at equidistant from it at the corners of equilateral triangles. So that if, for example, we'll meet the ant. If the ant came out of here and found the termites up here, it knows to make beeline back. Okay? This is how it does it, but you know, there's a little bit more in detail exactly how. There's another point, a couple of points to be made here. This stuff, these are equidistant, equal spaced. Okay? Einstein had pointed out, you can tell whether space is curved or flat, and you couldn't, by putting out this array of triangles. If you can make them all flat, without having to squinch them up, so to shorten some of these distances, then you have Euclidean space. You can't really do that in our space. You get close, but depending on what else is there. So what this means is that the rat, and presumably the human, probably the ant, are hardwired to believe that space is Euclidean. Okay? Whereas actually it's not. Next point. Donald Hoffman, excellent TED talk a while back on, you know, is reality as we perceive it? He says no. Donald Hoffman says there is a biological advantage, an evolutionary advantage, to having incorrect perceptions. Okay, you live better. You're going to do better in terms of survival. Why is that? Well, to get a correct perception would require much more complicated mechanisms, okay? Which means a bigger brain, which means more energy used. We already use, for an active person, 20% of the energy goes to support 2% of the brain, of the matter of the body, which is the brain. If it were bigger, it would be worse. And that would mean less nimble, and also, this is fast, okay? Whereas if it were more complicated, it would take longer, which would mean that our forebears would have been eaten by tigers. And on top of that, you know, well, there's the energy usage, the size of the brain, the nimbleness of the animal, etc. It's better if they have incorrect perception. They live better. They survive better. I'll give you another example of that later on if you want. Here you have a place cell. Actually, not one, but eight different place cells, which are arranged in such a pattern that the rat knows where he is on this line that goes around the room. Okay, I'm not going to talk about the other two at the moment. Just about the last slide. Belief in God is almost inevitable. I showed you pictures of two guys, Barrett and Boyer. They said that this hyperactive agency detection device is what causes you to believe in God. Okay. Because, I consider you're out for a walk in the woods a million years ago, and you hear a snap behind you. Well, yeah, it could be just coincidental. It could be that something fell out of a tree because the breeze was blowing. Or it could be a tiger. Now, if you think it's a tiger, and you run like heck, and it's not a tiger, yeah, what if you lost? A little bit of, you got a little bit of extra energy, exercise. But if you think it's coincidental, and it's a tiger, you probably won't have any children. So this hyperactive agency detection device has to be hyperactive for us to survive. It has to be wrong, a lot, okay? And therefore, we think that there are agencies out there doing things. Now, it's interesting about these two guys. They've been partners. They've gone all over the world doing tests and so forth. And they quote each other more than anybody else. So they work together. And they like each other. Barrett is a conservative Christian. Boyer is an atheist. And they agree on all the facts. They just disagree about what the implication of the facts are. Boyer says, well, hey, we know why you believe in God. Heck, it's not right. Barrett says, well, we know why you believe in God, and, you know, maybe God intended that that should be the way you would clue in. Okay. I just lost that. Yeah. Well, I think I'm going to come on. Thank you. So, we don't know the noumena. The mind creates images of the noumena, the phenomena. These intuitions are built by mental modules that have evolved, and for good reason. This naive realism is inadequate, not for survival, for accuracy. Okay? They're very adequate for survival. It's not adequate for accuracy. Which you saw in the assumption of Euclidean space and other things. Absolute proof about the noumena doesn't exist. What we do is choose a paradigm and build a set of thoughts. Okay, enough. Let's see. It's complicated. Questions?
Okay. Hold on. Okay, please, we have about 15 minutes for questions. Please keep your statement relatively quick, make it relatively short, and we'll get to your questions.
What did Buddha have to say about time and space?
That they are codependent. They are not objective. We make them in our minds. So all this array of feelings, volitions, consciousness, etc., that creates time and space. At least our perception thereof. Well, we outside ourselves, we have no idea.
My conclusion from what you have said, because I agree so much with what you said, is that looking at reality, what I see is a materialistic relativism. How would you...
A materialistic?
Materialistic relativism. Would you comment on that? That's what I got.
Well, you know, the thing is, I didn't take a stance on the debate between Barrett and Boyer. I could see both of them as making sense. I understand that because you don't know what the noumena is out there, there are a lot of possible hypotheses that you could come up with. Pick one, you know, put your money down, that's your baby from there on. Prove it? No.
It's like going down the midway. You pay your money. And
yeah,
your
exactly.
Question. Hello. You were at pains to put that have evolved in brackets for the two thinkers who wrote before the discovery of
before 1859.
How important do you think Darwin's work was to epistemology going forward? How was epistemology permanently transformed by the realization that over sufficient amounts of time, even the physical characteristics of a species would change?
You know, without Darwin's theory of evolution, that cognitive science simply wouldn't exist. Because it's assuming that characteristics and modules within the brain evolve over time. Without that theory of evolution, that whole last part, you can chuck. Interestingly, while Einstein is after 1859, he never really refers to evolution of humans. He does talk about the evolution of theories. He uses the term evolution, but not in a biological way. I think it's important. I think that, and I included it because of the fourth instance, the fourth episode.
Yes, you've said several times that we don't know the noumena, we only know the phenomena. But it seems to me that as a scientist, the community of scientists generates models of the noumena, or generate, it takes the phenomena, takes the sensory inputs, let me use that term instead, that go into our heads to make the phenomena. And by using logic and experimentation and deduction, it creates models of the noumena. And in fact, for most of the things that we experience, which are in Euclidean space, of course, but most of the things we experience can be described very well by models that the scientific community over many generations has put together. So to say that we only know what's in our heads is really negating all the work that the community of scientists and practical people have done over the generations in making models that really tell us all we need to know about the noumena. If we know all the properties of the noumena, what are we missing? Why worry about it? Why not be like Buddha and say, it doesn't matter?
But you know, the thing is, we don't know all the properties of the noumena. We are constantly finding new properties of the noumena. For example, dark energy, dark matter, strong force, weak force.
For living our normal lives, it's true, as Einstein said, that our models keep evolving. But it's not as if we can't know enough about the things that are important to us to get along very well in life.
Yeah, we can operate. That's the phenomenal basis. I'm not suggesting that basing oneself on phenomena is not going to give you enough to survive. I am suggesting that the whole history of science, for that matter, the whole history of human thought, is a matter of coming up against new ideas and replacing old ideas with these new ideas. It's a constant process. And as Einstein says, there's a certain amount of, what's the word he uses, speculation involved. And there will never be a final physics. There will never be a final philosophy. It's an ongoing project which continues and continues. And I think the history of science demonstrates this.
Question
out
here.
Yeah.
Therefore,
Brian, back
in
the 17th century.
Go ahead.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the enlightening lecture. Actually, just a quick follow-up on the question of the gentleman is that, you know, scientists, what they do is they spend their day in the lab or on the piece of paper actually playing with mathematics, but then when they go out and try to explain to us, they say, oh, we have to invent some of these concepts, and you know, we in our head think that, oh, these things just exist. But in their minds, they're constantly playing with mathematical equations and whatever comes out, and that's the phenomenon. But my real question is that it's interesting that, you know, from the conversation, you didn't mention, and that's really common here, and of course in Anglo-American philosophies, to completely ignore Hegel, you know, saying, and French philosophers, which really have a lot to say about these things, especially Hegel and his notion of super-sensible world as built on top of. And I'm wondering why, or maybe it's just somebody. And then the French philosophers would typically say, well, we love languages. Everything is essentially created by language. You know, I'm saying language, you know, created all the concepts and thoughts. But
language, of course,
is phenomenal. And as to Hegel, Hegel is a rather strange fellow. Hegel had both the concept that, you know, we have only the phenomena, but then he went beyond that to create something else, including the spirit, which knows itself, views itself in history, and the development of history. This, it's kind of speculative. I don't really follow Hegel. I can't follow Hegel on it. Husserl would not have been. There are a thousand others that I might have picked. I just picked these because they impressed me.
So would Buddha agree or disagree with Einstein's notion that God does or does not play with dice?
Well, Buddha himself, speaking about God, basically said, don't worry about God. You know, you are in charge of you. You're in charge of yourself. Don't worry about God. He has nothing to help you with.
What about the dice,
though? From the Buddhist perspective, the individual creates that world. It's not up to God. The individual does it. Now, maybe the individual throws the dice and generally has bad luck. He generally ends up in dukkha.
No gambling, that's what
ends in
dukkha.
Okay, when?
I
agree with Brian. I'm a scientist and I tend to be an empiricist. And all these people are trying to explain the way the brain works, how the mind works, how we perceive the world around us. And,
that's why I picked them.
Yeah. and whoever made this brain or how it evolved, it's to serve a function, you know, to help us survive in this crazy world around us. So whether we perceive or see things out there that are really real, or we place cause and effect and say they're caused by spirit or whatever, the effect is really to make us able to function. And so what difference does it make, what theory, you know, what epistemology we place on it, if we have the practical, empirical use of this brain, you know, making sense of the world?
Let me give you one thing that makes it very important. There is a widespread assumption that I know what's real. I know the truth. And if you don't agree with me, it's up to me to kick your butt. Everybody has to agree with me. And this is a bad basis for interacting with others. And I think that if you understand that everybody has a certain amount of choice in picking what kind of a model of reality they want to use. Not that, you know, they'll be equally good. A lot of them won't be. And maybe when you can show somebody that his model for understanding reality is defective in certain areas, then maybe they'll change their mind and come to a somewhat better. They may not pick yours, but at least they might pick a better one. So that's a very important issue. That's why it's very important to understand there is no final physics.
One last question.
So your example that you just gave was a very specific situation.
It applies to ISIS. It applies to
That's where we're going. Did the jet airplanes crash into the World Trade Center, and did it fall down?
According to my model, it did. They did.
And a few other billions.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people agree with that, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, let's give a round of applause to you.